Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 28th, 2020. This week, we're going to look at the proposed ERC revisions and why they're proposed and why we're not talking about final things. As always, current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers. I'll be putting on this week's session. So we'll take a look at what goes on, kind of work our way through this here today. Let's talk about what we're going to be looking at today. In essence, what's in today's session. And this week's topics are kind of interesting. And what we're going to have this week is, first, we're going to take a look at the status of what's known as the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021. And this was the bill that was passed, but has now become a little uncertain as to whether it will actually ever become law. But just in case it does, we're going to look at the proposed employee retention credits, which are plural. That'll be the highlight of this week's session, because I think this is something that a lot of us kind of didn't pay a lot of attention to, because either if your company got a Paycheck Protection Program loan, you couldn't get this, or if it didn't get a loan, you probably were saying, well, I really didn't have that big of a problem, and I'm not going to qualify under any of the rules. So you may not have paid a lot of attention to the ERC. If, in fact, the law we have here or a version of that law does become passed, then suddenly the ERC becomes important. And what's going to add to the confusion just a bit is we actually have three versions of it now. We'll talk about the 2020 version, retroactively 2020 version, if these changes are found. And this is going to be found in Section 206 of the Act, so we'll call it a 206 ERC. We'll then talk about the version that would take effect for 2027. And that's going to be our 207-style ERC. We'll talk about that. And then there is a third category for entities and businesses that were shut down to a disaster that's not COVID-generated. And that'll be a special new version for qualified disaster employee retention credits. And again, this will be under a bill that's actually very similar to what we saw last year in last year's Comprehensive or Consolidated Appropriations Act 2020 that ended up with the SECURE Act. Plus, then we got these disaster relief provisions, and we got extenders. Well, guess what? This year, we're looking again at this year's new thing will be the COVID relief items, more extenders, and more disaster relief provisions were in this bill. But again, this week, I'm not going to do a deep dive into the entire bill. Rather, I just want to look at the employee retention credit, because that, and again, no assurance any of this will become law. Let's underline that multiple times. There is no assurance that any of this will become law. But a lot of people have been thinking, well, if it does, or at least if we get something similar, we eventually get something, that these are likely to be part of whatever package does become law. And in that case, we need to be interested, because it's complicated how it works. So let's start talking about how we got here today. Well, first off, Congress passed the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021 on December 21st. The law passed the Congress overwhelmingly. So we had strong bipartisan support for both provisions. So we have this, you know, the bill passed and looked to be like no big deal. It looked like, hey, we had the bill passed. In fact, everybody started readying programs and readying things to go. And I know that some programs are even scheduled as early as Wednesday, you know, following the passage here on late Monday. There were programs scheduled and given on Wednesday. And that all looked to make sense, because when we came to the next day, first thing is this bill had been negotiated between Congress and representatives of the administration. That included Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, and the Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows. So that had been done, and Secretary Mnuchin was even out on the early part of the 22nd, stating that they were getting ready and that checks, the first checks would start arriving, the first money would start hitting bank accounts for individuals on these payments that were going to come, that would turn out to become a bit more of an issue a little bit later in the day. But they would start being issued effectively beginning on the 28th. so that we're going to be seeing a lot of things, at least the week of the 28th. And if you read that section of the bill, which we're not going to talk about here today, but you'll discover that the checks are supposed to go out by the 15th of January, which is also a potential issue when we'll get to a couple of other things about what might have to happen. But we had that going. So apparently, you know, there have been assurances given that basically the bill would be signed by Secretary Mnuchin and the Chief of Staff. Secretary Mnuchin clearly appeared to be telling everybody it's going to be signed. He's got this publicity out about sending checks ready. So presumably, he may have been somewhat surprised when in the evening the president posted a video that was critical of the bill, specifically worrying about the fact that he wanted the payments to not be $600 per person, but to be $2,000 per person, which of course would raise the cost of the package, and cost had been a sensitive issue. And he was also concerned with certain specific spending that were part of the Appropriations Act. And again, all of these things, this act is in many ways one giant conglomeration, 5,600 page, giant conglomeration of multiple bills they were trying to pass at year end in one big blob. So we have all kinds of weird things sitting inside of here. Now, the president said that he would not sign the bill unless the numbers were increased to $2,000 for the payments and if those spending programs were not removed from the bill. Now, there's a little complexity here that there's no, well, it's relatively simple to fix the $2,000. Not necessarily quite as easy to fix the appropriation to unappropriate after appropriating. It gets kind of interesting because you can fix the $2,000 by just passing essentially a $1,400 add-on that would be rolled in with it that could get you there, and that separate bill could go in. That'd be easy. But otherwise, it's kind of weird because realistically, the only way to change the bill would be to repass it essentially. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting, and obviously time is becoming somewhat of an issue. And time's an issue for a wholly different reason here. And this is one you need to keep in mind as we hear discussions this week about whether the president will sign the bill or will he veto the bill. Well, in reality, one of those weird little things in the U.S. Constitution that rarely comes into play, but the situation now is perfectly aligned to get what's called a pocket veto into play. Now, for those who may have ignored this in your fifth grade civics lesson that you had about the U.S. government or your high school government course, let's quickly review the pocket veto. And what happens in a pocket veto is, generally, under the Constitution, the president has 10 days to either sign or veto a bill. If the president does neither, then generally, the bill becomes law. If the president vetoes the bill, it is to be returned to Congress, at which point then Congress would have an opportunity, if they wish, to override that veto by having a two-thirds vote of each house, beginning with the chamber in which it was first passed, and then going to the other chamber. So that's normal operation. But here's the problem. The president has 10 days to act and to give the veto. And if he vetoes it, he is to return it to Congress. The problem occurs when the president gets the bill less than 10 days before the Congress formally adjourns for this particular Congress. And we are within that 10-day realm once we got the day it finally got to the president, which was on Christmas Eve. So essentially, the answer is not will he sign it or will he veto it. There is a will it be signed, will it be vetoed, or will it be simply never signed? And if never signed, then under the pocket veto rule, because as soon as they adjourn, there's no option for the president to send it back to Congress, the rule that automatically becomes law if he doesn't sign it goes away, and suddenly we're in a position where, yeah, the bill dies. Now, if it dies, the new Congress could pick it up, but that would require the new Congress to pick it up and start over again. So, again, we are in that role at this moment. Understand where we're at. But that said, you may notice when I talked about what the objections were to this bill, nowhere in the objections was any mention made of the employee retention credit. That leads a lot to believe, and actually I believe, that if we do get a bill, either it's this one that is passed, the president signs it, the president vetoes it and it's overridden, or somehow after the new Congress comes in, we pass the same bill and it becomes law either by overriding a veto or by waiting for administrations to change, because again, we're scheduled to have a change in who would sign the bill on January 20th. So, that also is an option in play. I have a feeling that the ERC changes would be part of that bill. So let's talk about those changes because they get complicated. Okay, so now again, remember the caveat here. As I noted right away, there is no guarantee that any of this becomes law. So let's please start with that guarantee. There is no guarantee any of this ever becomes law. So starting with that, let's discuss the three employee retention credits that we got as part of the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021. There are two bills that contain employee retention credit revisions or a brand new ERC, right? And in reality, there are two ERCs, but the one has a 2020 version and a 2021 version. So if you go first to the Taxpayer Certainty and Disaster Relief Act of 2020, which is basically the COVID-style relief thing for businesses, et cetera, and the extenders, this provides that in Section 206 of that act, it's very, very important. When you are looking at this, if you're going back at it, you need to remember one thing. The Section 206 of that part of the act has changes that apply retroactively to the ERC from the date it was first added to the law back with the CARES Act. So this effectively sets, after making these changes, you have the new version retroactively effective of the ERC, the Employee Retention Credit, that applies for 2020 payments. Then the law goes on and Section 207 makes more changes. But in 207, those changes only impact 2021 revisions. 207 extends the program into the first two quarters of 2021, but then makes far more significant revisions to how the program works. So you're going to have the 2020 ERC, and I'll call these like the COVID ERCs. We'll have the 2020 COVID ERC, the 2021 COVID ERC is your second choice. And then finally, in the Taxpayer Certainty and Disaster Relief Act of 2020, we will have a brand new employee retention credit that applies to taxpayers who had their businesses shut down or curtailed due to a disaster that was not COVID related during 2020 or during a slight period into 21. Kind of like we had last year with special disaster provisions. This is one of a number of them, but it is essentially a brand new ERC. Because of that, as I said, we end up now with three different ERCs. So when we're talking about the employee retention credit now, you need to be very, very careful which one of these three we're talking about, because they are all very, very different. And that becomes a key issue for us to deal with. So let's start talking. First, let's talk about the 2020 version of this. Okay, the 2020 version of this is in the Taxpayer Certainty and Disaster Relief Act of 2020, and it is Section 206. Now, let's talk about some of the major changes here. The 2020 Act, really the one huge change that is retroactive into 2020, is we no longer have an absolute bar for taxpayers who got an employee retention credit being unable to get, or I should say, got a PPP program loan, whether or not forgiven, from being able to make benefit of the employee retention credit. Now, remember, the employee retention credit is going to pay you a credit equal to 50% of the wages. for your employees, up to $10,000 in 2020 for wages per employee. It's going to do it up to that level, so you'll get the credit there. During quarters, during periods where either you were subject to full or partial shutdown due to COVID-19, or you had a substantial decline in revenues with substantial decline for a quarter set to a drop of 50% versus the same quarter in 2019, and then that would continue on until the first quarter after. The quarter after the first quarter, you basically got your revenues back up to 80% of 2019 levels or the end of 2020. Okay. That's the basic rule we had. So previously, if you got a PPP loan, we didn't worry about the ERC because you gave up the ERC if you got a PPP loan. But now we're going to be able to use both. Now there is a bar on double dipping. Okay. You cannot use the same payrolls, the same wages, wage payment, for both the Paycheck Protection Program and the Employee Retention Credit. That's also fairly clear under the law. Now, what's weird is that we have a potential election going forward that you would make to exclude wages from the ERC, right, and Employee Retention Credit, and that presumably opens them up for PPP loan purposes. However, obviously, that was never done in the past. So it's not clear how retroactively we're going to make that work. You know, will people have to go back and identify how much are we, you know, if we put more wages on the forgiveness form, if we already filed it, had forgiveness granted, you might have put more wages on the form than you needed just to have a cushion, right, to be sure. You know, does that mean all of them now are considered to be tainted, no ERC? Or can we go back and figure out how much of those wages we had to have on the application form to get full forgiveness? I mean, there's all kinds of complications to figure out exactly how much in the way of wages were used to get forgiveness, what they were, and, you know, do we pick and choose employees? And how do we do that given the complications of, you know, what we have to count? And yeah, it becomes messy. We're just going to say it that way. It's very, very much a messy computation. But, you know, presumably we would get guidance on this. My guess is there probably will be, if I was allowed to write the guidance, which I'm not going to be allowed to do it, I wouldn't be surprised though to see them say that you're able to compute the minimum amount of wages that were on your application form that are necessary for the full forgiveness, and then you could claim the ERC on the rest. But again, that needs to be clarified. We don't really know how that's going to work. Okay. But the good news is we apparently will get something, because remember, at best, you got 2.5 months worth of payroll. It is very possible, assuming you were able to use up your PPP funds and you were still operating, there's a decent chance you had other wages not paid for by the funds, which means those wages can definitely be used to claim your employee retention credit. Some other changes for 2020 were made. They did clarify gross receipts for tax-exempt organizations, because remember, we're measuring a decline in gross receipts. They make it clear here that we're going to use essentially the gross receipts that you have to report as gross receipts on the Form 990. They made the cross-reference there, so that's how that one's going to work. They moved health care costs to wages under the new program. I think that's more for clarification. It also would therefore make it very clear the $10,000 per quarter limit would apply to your wage plus the payroll, you know, the wage paid plus the health care costs. So I think that's also a clarification. And one other thing which they did with the Act was, whoops, it's a little too far if you watch their slides. What's going to be unique, though, is if you are going to claim, and this is another problem if this bill gets delayed. In theory, the design of the bill is you are going to claim your payroll tax credits on the fourth quarter 941. So what you'll do is instead of having to go back and file a 941X for potentially the second, you know, for I guess potentially even the first quarter, the first, second, third, and fourth quarter of 2020 to claim your ERC and try to get a refund there. Rather, you're going to figure out how much you would essentially, what your credit would have been for those quarters, and you'll be able to report that on the fourth quarter 941 and make a get a refundable credit there. Now, as I said, with the timing of this, it becomes a little more interesting now, because our problem is going to be, you know, how in the world do we handle this? The IRS is going to need at least some time to put the forms together. Obviously, we don't know if this is going to happen yet or not. And then there still has got to be time for forms to go out and for things like payroll services to be able to ramp up, to be able to even handle that sort of thing. And they're going to have trouble doing that without seeing the forms. So again, we are under a clock, and that's going to especially be a problem if this moves to the next Congress. And we'll talk about that at the end of the session, about what happens now, you know, moving forward. If we get a bill, when will we likely get it, and in what shape will it be? But let's just say that the timing for a lot of things becomes very, very difficult if it moves to the next Congress. So in essence, if we don't have this as law by January 3rd, when the current Congress leaves town, or effectively is thrown out at noon on that day as the new Congress is seated, things may get very, very complicated moving forward. Now remember, okay, these are things that have this. Now, the next issue is going to be in Section 207 of the Act. These are changes that affect 2021 only. I think that's really important to understand, right? These are going to be 2021 changes only. So what we're going to do, first thing is, please remember, every single 2020 change goes ahead and comes over. So all those 20 changes, you know, those are already in the bill because they took effect as of the date that the CARES Act was enacted. So those stay put where they are. But what we're going to do now is we're going to go ahead and we're going to move everything back into 2021. So we're going to extend the ERC into the first half of 2021. So it will apply for the first and second quarters. Presumably, Congress is betting that by the end of June, the vaccines will be out, they'll be widely distributed, and we will be generally, in theory at least, over the COVID situation, and thus this program will not be needed to be extended beyond that date. But we do have that. Okay. Now, like I said, be very careful. Everything we're talking about from this point forward, right, only applies to this 2021 version. It does not apply to the 2020. You cannot amend 2020 payroll tax returns, or can't catch up on the fourth quarter 2020 payroll tax returns to make any of these changes. These changes are prospective only, first and second quarter of 2021. Incredibly important to understand that. And also, I want to say this again in this program, please remember that until the bill is signed into law, or until it passes in some form and becomes law, none of this yet applies to anything. So that's either the 20 or the 21 version. So be sure to keep that in mind. But under this program, beginning in 2021, the $10,000 limitation on wages paid to a single employee will swap from being a, you know, kind of annual test into what will become now a per quarter test, right? I guess previously we probably should say, to be fair, it was a lifetime test, right? Because it just simply said $10,000 paid to an employee. The theory was it wasn't going to last past the end of 2020. Therefore, you don't really have to say it was for year 2020. As a practical matter, now the 2020 version is going to be a $10,000 annual wage test for covered wages in that time period that you're claiming a credit for each employee. This, under this rule, we will reset. So the first quarter, you can get a credit up to $10,000 of wages per employee. That resets to zero, and in quarter two, you can again claim up to $10,000 per employee. So like I said, if your employees are earning at least $40,000 a year, in theory, you'll be able to now max them out, get credit both times. While previously, if your employees all earned more than $40,000, you would have probably maxed them out in the first quarter regardless, and would not have gotten a credit the second, so now is going to be that change. The other change is it becomes a lot easier to qualify for this. Instead of looking at your revenue for the quarter and seeing if it's less than 50% of the revenue that you had in the same quarter the prior year, we're now going to go to an 80% gross receipts test. So that'll make it a little bit easier, right? We'll qualify under that. So substantial gross receipts test will move to a smaller number. So it'll be easier. We need less of a reduction in gross receipts to qualify for this program. So that'll make it simpler for you, right? A lot easier to meet the criteria than if you had to have a 50% drop. Now we still compare against 2019, at which also is probably a good thing because 2020 revenues are probably down substantially. And I suspect that for a lot of people, they're not going to see a yet again 50% decrease in 2020, in 2021 versus 2020. However, if you were not in business in 2020 or 2019, then you have to use 2020 as your measuring stick again. So that it allows you to at least on paper qualify for this. You just probably aren't going to have much chance of qualifying for it in reality. That'll be the background, but at least you have a chance to do it. There is an odd election that lets you use the prior rather than the current quarter for a substantial decline in revenue testing. I guess the theory of that is, well, now I know for sure. I'm not sure how many people that'll be better where the drop in the fourth quarter of 2020 compared to fourth quarter of 19 is more, you know, is will qualify, but it would have as first quarter of 20 versus first quarter 21 versus first quarter of 19. Nevertheless, it's there. They also allow on a limited basis, some government entities would qualify for the employee retention credit. So we end up getting this, you know, the government agencies that would qualify would include anyone that's a 501c3 organization that's exempt from tax under 501a, any college, university, or any government entity whose principal purpose is providing medical or hospital care. They all would qualify for this relief provision. So that could be useful. One of the bigger changes that will affect some employers that I should be aware of is the number of full-time employees to be considered to be a large employer would basically go up to 500 or less from 100 or less for 2020. And why that's important is employers who are small employers are able to get the credit on wages paid to all employees, whether performing services, you know, including those currently performing services during the distress period. If you are a large employer, the credit only applies to amounts you pay to people who are performing no services for you. So obviously, it is better to be a small employer. Again, this change of number does not go back into 20. It only counts for 21. But it will give you that advantage where you have this. We also have a bit of a simplified double benefit rule, which, you know, has a list of various credit sections. If your wages count for this credit, you can't use it for ERC as well. So that's a bit easier. There also is a unique option where an employer can ask for and receive an advance payment of their expected 2021 employee retention credit. So you can ask for the money up front rather than just using it to offset your payrolls as you each payroll pay somebody for that amount. There's a true-up provision that's in there to allow us to fix this in some way, shape, or form if things don't come out the way we expect. But it's an interesting provision that would say that in early 2021, a client who, you know, pretty much is going to be impacted for sure by the ERC, and I guess that's part of the reason maybe for the look back, because if in fact you qualify based on the fourth quarter of 2020, then by definition with that look back, if that one hasn't made 80%, then you could be sure that you're going to be okay for the first two quarters of 21. So that may be the reason for that crazy election. And like I said, I was trying to figure out what it is because it didn't seem like a real obvious reason why that's there, but I suspect it's something of that sort. And that would allow you then to be sure for two quarters, and that could make you much more confident of asking for the full 6 months of advanced payment of 2021 ERC and not find yourself fouled up when it turns out that your revenues in the first quarter recovered quickly because, I don't know, we managed to figure out how to get vaccines out much more rapidly and therefore business goes back to normal instantly and your revenues are back up above 80% and, oh boy, well, things, you know, now suddenly you're not going to get that credit in the second quarter. In theory, I guess, by using the throwback a quarter election, you could push that back off to another, to basically to make sure you got the first two quarters of this year. Now, there is one other thing. Now, at the end of the day, we went on and we got a brand new version too. So this one is found essentially in the part of the bill that relates to our disaster provisions. And what happens here is we're going to get a brand new employee retention credit that applies to taxpayers affected by a presidentially declared disaster. Now, key, it is very clear this disaster cannot be one declared for COVID. So, and essentially, you're not allowed to get this one and the other one at the same time. You know, your disaster, if the COVID disaster is what does this to you, then you are stuck with having to claim this based on the COVID disaster issues. You're not going to be able to, on the COVID rules we mentioned, you're not going to be able to get this under these rules as well. Now, generally, our disaster period in this case, right? It has to come from January 1st, 2020 through 60 days after the date of enactment. So it's a presidentially declared disaster under the Stafford Act. And it has to have begun in, or, you know, in the period from January 1st, 2020 until 60 days after the date of enactment. My guess is certain things like the wildfires in southern, in all of California, essentially, and on the West Coast, my guess is that there you may see many of the disasters that would hit this, at least potentially, if you were basically forced to close your business due to these disasters. We could also see it for hurricanes, right, and that sort of thing. Now, the reason why this one is interesting, and even if your clients were not hit by a non-COVID disaster this year, or they're going to get their credit on the COVID version, which is more generous than this one, the reason why you might want to look at this, though, is this probably is going to serve as a template for Congress to roll out this relief automatically in the future to victims of disaster. It appears Congress now is doing it by, you know, passing a bill at the end of every year that just is kind of this omnibus disaster relief bill instead of what they used to do, which is pass a different bill after every disaster. They would start passing all of these individual bills. Now they seem to be waiting till the end of the year and pass an omnibus bill. Now, your period involves, so the period you can qualify for this is basically the period you're shut down or can operate, or if earlier, the end of what's called the incident period. And the incident period is either when the state of emergency, you know, is ended, declared done by FEMA, or a date that is no more than 30 days after the date of enactment. So this will roll into for a little while into 2021, but essentially 30 days in that any disaster would end by that date. So essentially that's going to be an issue. So, and it is kind of weird because the incident period's got in 30 days after date of enactment, but they claim the disaster could start 60 days. And yeah, we'll work that out later as to how in the world that could work. But that's a different issue. Okay. Now, the actual credit is not as generous as it is for the COVID ERC. The percentage of wages is 40%, not 50%. And the maximum wages per employee you can consider is going to be $6,000. That is not per quarter, but that is for the entire emergency. So you have to go ahead and run it for that as well. Now, they talk about this qualified wages for these purposes. As I've said, generally it's going to be wages that are paid to employees during a period when your business is essentially closed or can't have normal operations due to the disaster. But it does say that these credits can be paid for wages paid to employees who are not currently working for you, you know, if you keep them on payroll, or even those that work for you at an alternative site or via, you know, alternative structures, you know, temporary arrangements, but not at your main facility until you get back up and running there, you can still claim the credit, right? And there's a special version of this that will also apply to tax-exempt organizations. So again, it looks like the ERC, which became a kind of COVID-only, one-time-only bill action, may very well come back now for us, and we may keep seeing this in future bills, because it looks like Congress kind of likes the idea of this way of doing it. So now the big question, get out your crystal ball. What exactly is going to happen now? Remember, as I told you, the bill we have right now has not been signed by the president. I'm recording this on Sunday at just about 11:30 11:30 a.m. on Sunday. And as of that time, at least when I started recording this a few minutes, you know, about 20 minutes ago, I had not seen any reports the president had signed the bill. If he has in the interim, well, then forget what I'm going to say, because you'll know what happens. I also have not heard that he vetoed the bill, in which case then this would still be relevant we're going to talk about here, you know, but we'll just have to see what happens. So that's it. Be sure to check and see the status of the bill. But if the status still is in limbo, let's talk about our options here. What exactly could happen? Well, remember, the current Congress adjourns by noon Eastern Standard Time on January 3rd, 1 week from the date this is dated, which is September 28th. Not September, I should say December 28th. Get the right date in there. So basically, if it's not law by noon on January 3rd, then effectively we are going to have to do a restart. Now, even if the president signs it before January 3rd, then this bill becomes law, and everything in the bill stays forward. If the president has not signed it by that date, and we go past noon that day, then most likely it would be a pocket veto, and the bill's dead. I'd have to go back and check my constitutional, whatever old civics book to see. I believe the president could still sign it within the 10 days, even if Congress is adjourned. He just can do the pocket veto by not signing. And I suspect, I don't know the exact timing, but I think the 10th day might end up being the 4th. So in theory, you know, he could sign it on the 4th and have it work. But let's assume if he doesn't sign it by the 3rd, it's probably not going to become law. If he vetoes it, it's still complicated, because it would have to be enough time for Congress to pass to get an override vote scheduled and held before their period adjourns on January 3rd. If any congressman, or probably more significantly senator, wants to slow the process down because they oppose the bill, and remember, it was not a unanimous vote, so if they want to slow it down, there's a good chance if things aren't, you know, if the bill is not vetoed probably by, you know, the end of day here on Sunday, that, the clock could be run out by, you know, those in Congress who may oppose the bill, even if there were overwhelming votes to override the veto. So obviously that's one of the pieces of reality. Now, it may be that if it became clear there were overwhelming votes to override, it's very possible that Congress and those same votes would be there in the next Congress, that you might be able to persuade them. There's little point in pushing this off, but we'll have to see. If it goes to the next Congress, things get more complicated. What the next Congress cannot do is override the veto, because they didn't pass the bill. Since they didn't pass the bill, they can't override. So this next Congress cannot override the bill that was passed by this Congress seated right now on December 21st. They are not going to be able to vote to override. They would have to start over again if they're going to do anything. So this is a reset and start over. Now, the quickest way probably, but again, it would depend on not having a lot of opposition, is they could just pass this exact same bill again, send it back to the current White House. Presuming the president has not had a change of mind, there's a decent chance that he would again oppose it and want changes. There is a, you know, at that point, the only reason you just send it up with no changes without the president agreeing to sign it would be that you plan to override the veto. And again, now he's no longer can do a pocket veto at this point. His term ends, you know, way before this Congress ends and way before 10 days. We're going to have, you know, it's not, the Congress is staying beyond 10 days. So because of that, he would have to veto at this time or sign it or just let it become law without signature. He could obviously delay that for 10 days. And also it would take Congress some time to vote a new bill. So we are probably looking optimistically at around January 15th as the earliest if it was going to be vetoed and veto overridden. And the 15th require a lot of things to work with no objections, which means we're probably looking much closer to the very end of the president's term before the override could be passed. The problem is, as I said, the checks are supposed to go out by January 15th. Presumably, they would have to go back in and change those dates, which could complicate return processing. If they did go back, you know, went back in to do that, there's also the problem of supposedly picking up the payroll tax refunds for the 2020, ERCs on the fourth quarter 941s, and a question that if Congress doesn't pass this bill until late in the month of January, let's say in the month of January after the 15th, will it even be possible for the IRS to design a form to allow us to claim that credit? And that's also going to be a big problem. So will they have to then move that into where you could claim it on the first quarter, or you can go ahead and amend prior 941s? So probably at least some tweaking would need to be done, and that then means that some tweaking means we've got to get language, which means then people have to review it again, and you can see we're suddenly sitting at a date problem unless the president has agreed to sign the bill when Congress delivers. Now, we could decide, wait, why don't we just open up the bill again? Because, you know, the president has said he needs changes to sign the bill. Well, you could do that, but it's kind of like opening up a partnership agreement for a partnership, right? The reason why like large law firms and large accounting firms resist like mad going back and making any changes to their partnership agreements is once you've opened the door to changes, it's very, very difficult to only have changes in the areas that you opened it up for and not suddenly have people trying to sneak in other changes, want to discuss other issues. And so, you know, that may be opening Pandora's box. And the problem there is that, again, there might not be time. In essence, it took 7 months to negotiate the bill we have. You know, can we get that reopened and these changes made and not make others? And can all that get done and a bill passed before January 20th? Because after January 20th, the occupant of the White House changes. And that means that, you know, it now becomes not what does President Trump want? It becomes what does President Biden want and what will he sign? So then that brings up the next question. Do we pass it after the inauguration of President Biden if he says he will sign the bill? Because obviously if you're Congress, you can just wait till the current term for president ends and wait till the next one starts. Just like the president's waiting for the new Congress, the Congress can wait for a new president and wait for it to start and swap that. Well, that works fine if the president-elect says he will sign the bill as is. It may not work so great, though, if he says, you know what? I mean, I want to negotiate now. You know, I want some changes. And how late does that drive things? And the other problem is, you know, how quickly can we get it passed after he is inaugurated? And then you're looking, like I said, since he's not inaugurated till the 20th, you're definitely looking the latter part of the month if it goes that way. Where do we stand at this point? I don't think anybody knows where this is going and how quickly it's going to move. It could be that all of this is taken care of early in the week and it's like nothing ever happened and everything quietly goes away. Or it could be that, yeah, we're sitting with end of January changes that we're going to be sitting on this, not knowing till the end of January if we're getting changes and if we are, what those changes are. So be aware of that. Now, as I said, you might wonder, why did I cover this week? Well, I covered it because every question I'm getting currently relates to this bill and how it would work, because it is the only game in town currently. I certainly believe that if we get a bill, it's almost certainly going to be based on this particular structure, right? Certainly for the ERC, and the ERC is major changes. But when that's going to happen and when your clients will be able to get money out of this, you know, be able to get their refunds, be able to get some, you know, relief under these provisions or the other provisions in the bill, those are very, very, very much up for question, and we don't know at this point. So with that, I'm sure great news, right? We're entering on great news this week. I want to remind you this has been the current federal tax developments here for the week of December 28th. I'll keep wanting to say September. December 28th, 2020. This is our last broadcast for this year. We'll start next year with the New Year's edition, the January 3rd edition of this, and we'll talk about updates at that point. If you have any questions, you can email me, edzollers@currentfulltaxdevelopments.com. You can also visit our website at currentfulltaxdevelopments.com to get our updates. If you are a member of the state societies in Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Washington, right, and Illinois, I do look in on their Connect sites from time to time, and if you have questions, you can post them there. Otherwise, we'll look forward to seeing you guys back here next week. We'll see if we have a new law or we have any new developments to deal with next week. And if nothing else, we'll take a look at, because we have a couple of regulation sets we need to look at and a couple of other things that have happened recently. So we'll take a look at that and go over all the neat things happening in the area of current federal tax developments.